Welcome back, everybody. I'm joined today once again by Mr. Ian Davis. We had a talk last time, and it was about multipolarity, about the globalist agenda and false narratives. And we left off just as the conversation. I mean, it was a very long conversation. We covered a lot of ground, and it was at the end of the conversation that we started getting into accelerationism, dark enlightenment, sort of controlled opposition, Silicon Valley elites, and really there was just no more time for the discussion. But I said, well, we have to come back to this. This is a great topic. It's really, you know, I've never heard anyone talk about it in depth, and you seem to have really done your homework on it. So I said, we have to meet again. We have to flesh this out. And so I'm glad that you could join me today. How are you doing, sir? How does the topic strike you? Are you ready to go? Are you ready to dive deep?
Yeah, thanks very much for inviting me back on, Rurik. Yeah, it's a very important topic because, as you quite rightly said, it's something that most people don't know much about. But when we start looking at what is happening around the world, it is everywhere. It colours nearly everything that is happening at, you know, if we talk about the globalist level, then it colours nearly everything that they're doing. So, for example, you know, the number of just in the UK government, I'm UK based, so the number of UK government accelerators, they've got innovation accelerators, they've got procurement accelerators, they've got health accelerators. They're constantly using this term acceleration or referring to acceleration. You've got things like the agreement between and the term constantly crops up. You know, they're always saying we've got to accelerate this or we've got to accelerate that. When the World Economic Forum formed its partnership with the United Nations, it said that the purpose of that was to accelerate the implementation of the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development. So this is an agreement between the World Economic Forum and the United Nations to do this thing, accelerate. So normally when we look at that language, most of us would just think, well, yeah, they just mean speed things up a bit. That's what most of us think the word accelerate means. But there is a definite ideology behind accelerationism. And the term is used so much and so widely. You know, for example, there a speech that was given by the current foreign secretary in the UK, a guy called James Cleverly. He used the accelerate term in a relatively short speech about 12 times. They just keep saying it, and you do have to start wonder if in fact there is an agenda behind it, what that agenda is. And if we sort of pick apart what accelerationism is, then certainly we can see that there almost certainly is an agenda behind it, and that's why they keep using the phrase.
Yeah, well, let's get into that agenda then, because there's a left hand and a right hand component to it. So it's like a two-headed beast. It approaches from it converges from supposedly opposed political camps, and the justification is provided by bought and paid for intellectuals on either side. So, you know, you have to justify it in terms of left-wing ideology. So you use some Marxist terms to explain it. You use Marxist vocabulary, and you use language that is sort of it's signal coded to appeal to leftists. Like a leftist knows that they're talking to a leftist because they're using leftist approved speech in the same way that a right winger intuitively feels that he's talking to a right winger because of the terms and the concepts that are used. So am I right in concluding that it is being advanced from both the left and from the right? And perhaps we should start by examining the agenda in greater detail from the right. Could you fill us in on that?
So the right wing perspective of it comes from a body that started back in the 1970s and early 80s, and then onwards, coming out of Warwick University in the UK. There was a group of young kind of iconoclastic disruptors, we might call them today, of intellectuals, led by a guy called Nick Land, who were working at a Warwick University, looking, kind of extending the kind of ideas that we might associate with Schumpeter's kind of creative destruction economic idea. So the idea is that you break down current economic, and it, while Schumpeter was very much focused on economic structures, this group at Warwick University, they started extending it to other things like, you know, social structures, political structures, even cultural kind of structures, and that you could use this kind of idea of creative destruction, which means purposefully breaking things apart in a kind of measured way in order to rebuild something new. So Land and the people there, he ultimately wrote something called The Dark Enlightenment, which was the document that he wrote, or the thesis that he wrote, or it's more than that, it's more of a treatise, really. He wrote this thing called The Dark Enlightenment, but he was basing that on his, and I know this was some years after, you know, this think tank at think tank at Warwick University. But he was basing that very much on his relationship with Peter Thiel, and Founders Fund, a guy called Curtis Yarvin, who'd written about this kind of idea before. And he was taking that work and kind of remodeling it into something, or not remodeling, kind of putting it into a kind of cohesive, well, say cohesive, it is like wading through mud when you actually read The Dark Enlightenment, but you can pick it apart. And he wrote this idea loosely based around Schumpeter's idea of creative destruction, which is the accelerationist component of what we're seeing. So this relates to the Dark Enlightenment. Accelerationism means a kind of supercharged process of creative destruction. So you really kind of smash things to pieces. The idea being that it's done in a constructive way, that you're going to you do it with a view to replacing it. But I think it's fair to say that what we're seeing at the moment, certainly if we look at things, for example, like global supply chains, they're just being smashed to pieces. There is an envisaged replacement or an envisaged model. You spoke about it earlier, the multipolar model. But at the moment, we're just going through the smashing everything to pieces stage, which is there's definitely an ideology underpinning it, this idea of the Dark Enlightenment. So
yeah, like before we jump into the ideology, I just wanted to remark that what you're describing sounds a lot like something Lenin would say: creative destruction, tearing things apart, accelerating the process of destruction. It's revolutionary language, and so if you were trying to create revolutionary conditions, or to what is the point of revolutions? A revolution is effected to put one group of people who are not as powerful as they'd like to be at the top. So that's what revolutions have always been. It's about one caste replacing another caste. And while they are in the process of creating this replacement, they have to disrupt things. They have to create chaos. So that makes sense to me. Let's see. The next question is, how do they justify this as a so-called right-wing ideology? What is this? What is the justification that Mr. Land has come up with in The Dark Enlightenment? I've actually read it, but it was 10 years ago. And I got to be honest, he writes very in a difficult way. So perhaps I'm a bit rusty on it. But from what I understand, and I'll throw it over to you, and you can tell me if I'm wrong or not, he basically says that we need to create a new elite. And the new elite has to be based on non-democratic values. And the new elite basically has to be these sort of neo-feudal lords, and they're going to be based in tech. And do I have the gist of it down? Or
yeah,
or,
yeah, I'd say that. Yeah. I'd say that's the gist of it. Yeah, I mean,
okay.
The thing is, they make it. He makes a critique of democracy, what we call democracy, right? So what we call democracy is representative democracy, right? We vote for someone or we elect someone and they represent us, right? That's basically the idea of representative democracy, you know. And it's the same all over the world, really. I mean, you know, you can look in. I mean, we have different systems and different methods of doing it, and it has more or less kind of validity, so claimed, you know, but it's the same in Russia, in China, in the, you know, there's this idea that you have these people that represent your interests. And, you know, some of that's done through electoral politics, some of that's done through, you know, an agreed, you know, you can only choose certain leaders and so forth. But however it's done, the idea is that you have these people that represent you, and that's representative democracy. Now, that is not democracy. So what Land was writing about, you know, I'm getting to the critique here before I've explained it, but just to say at the start, his notion of democracy is wrong, right? So the what he calls democracy is not democracy, and what Thiel calls democracy is not democracy. Democracy is the rule of law by trial by jury. That's all it means. It doesn't mean anything else other than that. Any epithet that we put with it means that it is not democracy. So they're starting from a point of critiquing the wrong thing, but nonetheless. Some of the critiques they make of representative democracy are pretty well made. I mean, he raises some good points. One of the points being that it creates this kind of moral certainty, you know, that this idea can never be challenged, and that morality ultimately decays into certainty about everything. And that means that, you know, that functioning dialectics in a society no longer work, because, you know, you can't challenge the unimpeachable moral superiority of the democratic system, alleged. And then he
could I jump
that,
in here? Yeah. Are you trying to say that democracy is based on moral totalitarianism? That I think I've written about this before from my perspective, and what it seems to me is that democracy is a very fragile thing, and it really doesn't stand up, it doesn't allow criticism of the system itself. In that sense, it's not any different than any other system. You know, like in communism, you can have parties, you can have elections, that you have elections in North Korea and in China, but you can't question the communism, you can't vote out communism. And liberalism is sort of the same. Is that you can't just criticize liberalism and be allowed in the political arena. You can't. Liberalism is always on the lookout for threats. For example, from the right, like a Hitler type figure, a populist champion of the people, getting voted in and then ending the democracy. Am I on the right track here? Is that and so they create a system of moral totalitarianism where it's like only the values of liberalism and democracy are, or representative, you know, the liberal bourgeois values are the only ones that are allowed, because, you know, we just can't have anything that could threaten the system. Is that about it, or is there more nuance to it?
No, I'd say that's pretty much it. And I think Land was right to identify that. So what Land said ultimately, how he interpreted that was, and Thiel as well, because Thiel wrote about this as well, as had Yarvin. So what their argument is that this is stultifying for development. You can't develop a modern economy in a modern society if there are these unimpeachable, never to be questioned moral precepts which define everything. And he said, you know, that what that means is that decision making is therefore severely limited by that entrenched moral certainty. So which may not be practical, you know, in certain circumstances, or and and stultifies the society's ability to develop. Because he argued, I mean, this goes all the way back to Aristotle, and you know,
Plato. This sounds a lot like Plato arguing, but Plato, just like these guys, was arguing for a foreign oligarchy. That was his thing. Plato was saying that, oh, we don't want an Athenian democracy. Let's import a Spartan oligarchy instead. That's the detail people don't know. But he was working against his own people, Plato. But I wrote a whole essay series, three essays. People seem to like it, and I'm like just completely shitting on Plato. I keep saying he's like the source of all evil, you know. But yeah, you're right. And I think these guys have a Platonian critique of what they consider to be democracy, the idea that like the masses can't be trusted and you need like an elite. And who's going to be the elite? Well, of course, we're going to be the elite because we think the right things. You know, that's the thing. Everyone says it doesn't matter what the system is and it doesn't matter what people are proposing. Fundamentally, they're proposing to put themselves in charge, you know, like that's every system has a ruling class, and you can make a lot of arguments criticizing the current system, which I do as well. But at the end of the day, it seems like these guys are just arguing for, again, an oligarchy where they will call the shots. And are they justifying this by saying that it will accelerate technological progress and the AI singularity, and that's why it needs to be done?
Yeah. So they're saying that in order to move forward, we need to move forward quickly. So there needs to be, a kind of fracturing of this restrictive morality and this useless political system. So they envisage the political system as completely useless and counterproductive. And the arguments they make, some of them are, you know, quite interesting. And, you know, there's a lot to be said for some of the arguments that Land put forward. So, but that brings us to this idea of smashing things apart at great speed and just a change in the oligarchy. I mean, they're just talking about, you know, that the oligarchy basically, and this, you can understand why where Thiel's coming from on this, the oligarchy's hands are tied by this kind of moral turpitude that is stopping them doing what really needs to be done. So that's the problem. The problem is not that, you know, the people are irrelevant. The people are just completely irrelevant in the Dark Enlightenment. Land talks about taking an inventory of everyone's sovereignty. And he discusses how that we, the people, our share of sovereignty is so infinitesimally, meaninglessly small that it's not really worth doing an inventory of our sovereignty. Our sovereignty doesn't really matter. It's the sovereignty of global corporations. It's the sovereignty of the political class. And even the political class, you know, he's not particularly, you know, their sovereignty is limited, he argues. So there's a lot of thing crossover there in perhaps some of the things that many of the rest of us talk about. But what he identified was that there was that what this inevitably led to was this kind of entrenched ruling entity. He called it a ruling entity. And this entrenched ruling entity was self-destructive because it was continually hampered by having to appeal to the electorate in a representative democracy, or having to appease the people. So it was hampered by that. And he called this ruling entity the cathedral. So he identified the ruling entity as this. So what he suggested was that you could do an inventory of the cathedral, and you could break it down into what he said, quote, the administrative, legislative, judicial, media, and academic privileges. So that these institutions, these components of the social kind of power structure, each have privileges which are afforded to them by that power structure. So what Land argued was, right, that the only thing that's interesting about that is the fact that these institutions and these organizations have power and they are able to exert it. That's the only thing that's of any interest. What they do with it is not of interest. the fact that they have this power is the interest. So we want to make an inventory of that. And what they suggested doing was converting that power. So we, you know, you measure everyone's power in some sort of measure, on some sort of measurable scale. And then you convert that, because they were very much looking at kind of digital, kind of tokenized world where everything's converted into digital tokens. And you can convert that into what they called fungible shares. So you allocate shares to each kind of body of power. They each have allocated shares. And he called that process caramelization, or cameralization. It's even difficult to say. And that he would convert everything into shares and thereby give it monetary value. So once it's got monetary value, the shares can then be sold. So you could buy power, is what he was fundamentally what he was saying, that you could buy power. And this would mean, and go, you know, this goes back to the idea of oligarchy and elite theory. This means that you could therefore allocate power based on economic, basically based on economic wealth. And this would create a corporate structure that would rule over society, which he called GovCorp. So GovCorp would manage society like you know, a corporation manages any kind of manufacturing operation or something like that. It would manage society through a corporate structure with allocated power being, and this was key to his argument, that once you'd smash the current political paradigm apart, this new political paradigm, which it's not even political, it's obviously it's dictatorial and tyrannical, but that it would enable you know, a more efficient and effective management of society. And we would be, you know, we would be like automatons that were allocated our functions. I mean, it's got a lot of, there's a lot of crossover with technocracy in terms of what the way that he kind of envisaged it. So we would be allocated our functions within this system, and, you know, our worth would be measured depending upon, I mean, to be fair to him, he didn't actually spend a lot of time talking about us, because we are, as in we, the people, because we are pretty irrelevant in his model. You know, the only purpose of GovCorp is to direct us in the right direction, pretty much. So
what's that direction? Like, all this fancy stuff, it must have an end goal. Like, what is the end goal here? Is it to create, I mean, with Land, he talks a lot about AI, about cybernetic Marxism. So what's Yarvin talking? What's the end goal? Other than, of course, getting himself in a very cushy position in the new regime.
Yeah, I mean, the end goal is to have us as kind of, how would you describe it? Bits in a computer system. You know, that it's very much about running everything more efficiently. So everything would be more efficient. So providing a better society that would be kind of, we would be kind of linked to AI controlled. I mean, he actually said, this is a quote, GovCorp would concentrate upon running an efficient, attractive, vital, clean, and secure country of a kind that is able to draw customers. So obviously, as GovCorp, the customers are us, but the customers are also other nation states run along a similar trajectory. So the customer is like an NPC, like a non-playing character, who acts as a kind of battery, if you like, to enable this system to continue. But the system quite clearly, although he didn't overtly say that the purpose, he kind of described it as the purpose was to run a more efficient society for the benefit of everybody, he argued. But quite clearly, the only people that truly benefit from what he was suggesting are the shareholders, you know, the shareholders of power, which following this process of camelarization, they would be allotted shares based upon their ability to buy them, presumably. So they're the only people that benefit. And we feed into that system and we basically just funnel wealth directly to them. And he thinks that would be more efficient.
Well, here's what it sounds like to me. It sounds like he's trying to convert economic power directly into political power. And he says that the process now is kind of messy. I mean, how does one go from being just rich to being politically powerful? It's a transition that many rich men in history have struggled to make. And so he's looking at probably these Silicon Valley nerds who cannot tie their own shoelaces together, but they have a lot of wealth and they're good at what they do, but they don't understand power at all. They're not going to be able to form their own militia. They're not going to be able to form their own political party. And in fact, you know, you could say that the current established system is all based in Washington and New York, not in San Francisco. And so he's saying, well, we need a kind of way for these nerds who can't do politics for them to somehow to be able to convert their economic power into political tokens. And with the economy, it's easy. You have dollar bills, right? But how do you measure power? Power also needs to be quantified. And I have a question. How does GovCorp decide like the exchange rate of currency to power? Like, how does it allocate power shares? Is it the AI decides, or who decides who gets more power?
Well, yeah, I mean, he spoke about this process of cameralization, and I wasn't entirely clear reading it quite how that would work. He kind of just sort of broadly says, yes, it will all be divided up and we'll all understand. But you know, how does the process, how you ask a good question, and it's a question that land should be asked, you know, what are the units, you know, what's the unit of power? How is that measured? What does it mean? I mean, he talks about an inventory of sovereignty, and I would go in now, we're shooting ahead again to criticize it. He's got sovereignty all wrong as well, because as far as he's concerned, sovereignty is merely measured in how many people you can manipulate. That's all sovereignty means. So if you can manipulate 10,000 people, then you've got, you know, sovereignty of 10 or whatever. You know, this is all it meant to them. They weren't thinking about sovereignty in the way that we might think about it. I mean, he also spoke about this idea of the technoplastic being, right? So that because he one of the arguments that Thiel and Land and Yarvin put forward. When we go talk about this stultified development, that this moral turpitude was kind of holding everybody back, and that was kind of stultifying everything, was that this was limiting our evolutionary step forward as a species,
and that cyborgs. He's talking about cyborgs. I knew you were gonna.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Yeah.
So he's talking about cyborgs, quite rightly. Right. And he is saying that, everybody needs to be so biology and medicine and technology will co-evolve together. We will be technoplastic beings, by which he means entities capable of being reformed by technology. So, you know, if we look at someone like Musk, you know, and his, you know, neural net. And things like that, this idea of us interfacing directly with digital processes and with AI, which is a complete misnomer, by the way, AI, it's just total bollocks. It's an algorithm. It's just a computer program. It's just, you know, it's people get very excited about AI, like we're approaching the singularity No, I don't think we are. I mean, it's just dumb AI. It's not a mind or anything close to being a mind. But
well,
that's what they want us to believe.
Yeah. Well, Nick takes an occult perspective on it, and he's into Kabbalah, and he thinks that basically you can summon a daemon from the new sphere into the circuitry, and that the circuits are like glyphs or seals or like the seal of Solomon or whatever. And so that's how you would create an AI, like an actual artificial intellect. You'd summon it from the warp and you'd imbue it in this machine. That's what he gets into with his, it's just a lot of it's really hard to decode because these people write in this way, and they claim it's to filter out dumb people, but I think it's to obscure their views. It sounds like tech communism to me. But one other thing that's really interesting is that I've always wondered, like on all those, you know, those agenda, like Agenda 2030, Agenda 20, whatever, there's been several, these smart city things. They always say, like, they always have the typical extreme left-wing causes. Like they're saying, we're going to create a carbon neutral city. We're going to cut down. We're going to make 15-minute cities. We're going to do all this stuff. And it's all like very leftist, like very SJW. We're going to create multicultural paradise. Everyone's going to live in a pod. It's going to be great. You're going to be like chickens in a coop. But then they always like throw in transhumanism into that. And I was always struck by that. That didn't make sense to me. Transvestites make sense to me as a leftist cause, but the transhuman, like the cyborgs. And I thought, oh, now I understand, because that's like them throwing a bone to this, the so-called right wing of this whole agenda. And like, that's the merger. That's the compromise. These guys want their cyborgs. Elon Musk and Silicon Valley wants their cyborgs and life extension and uploading consciousness and tech Kabbalah and all that sort of fun stuff. And they have money, so you know they have to be included. So these people say, okay, we're gonna have the green city, we're gonna have multicultural mulatto paradise. But okay, fine, you'll have your cyborgs too. Is that right? Like, is that, am I getting close to the left right pincer movement?
I appreciate and hear what you're saying. I mean, for me, I don't think the left right paradigm is really. I don't think the people like Musk and people like Yarvin and Land and Thiel, I don't think they care about that.
They position themselves as like being vaguely on the right. And Yarvin Land in particular, they've inspired, or like they're constantly cited by these like online sort of right-wing people. Who are based around this guy called Bap, Bronze Age pervert, Costin, some Romanian last name. He's very big. He wrote a book called Bronze Age Mindset. And basically he argues for like a cruel Platonic elite based on Nietzschean principles and eugenics. And, you know, just like very, it's very sort of... It's very materialistic, and so these guys are all buddies, and they all post together. They all go. They support each other's projects, and you know they share a lot in common. And listen, if you're anywhere near like the sort of right wing discourse on the internet, you can't help but be confronted by these people and their acolytes. So they're definitely right wing coded. I agree with what you're saying, that there doesn't seem to be much of a distinction. But what I'm saying is that other people do see it that way, and they're using language that appeals to people who do think in these terms. So, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, I mean, I would say it's a sales pitch. If you've got people with, I mean, everyone's got a different perspective, right? People across the world have got different perspectives. They got different values. So some people value the collective more than they value the individual. Other people, they value the... So broadly speaking, those people that value the individualism, we tend to see them to be more on the right. We call it the right. The people that are more into collectivism, we say they're more on the left. But really, these are just human opinions. They're opinions based on a set of values that people hold. Now, over the years, and obviously throughout history, we have that political ideologies and political ways of approaching problem solving and so forth have been developed to appeal to user bases or to follower bases, acolytes, as you put it. Now, if you're going to pitch something like this, which is the accelerationism, which is about destroying everything and building something new, you need to have people on board with it. So for people like Musk, who very much appeals to the kind of neoliberal left, then that's good. He's always going to push it from that perspective, because it may well be, something closer to his own heart in terms of what his values are. But it doesn't, ultimately, my point is, it doesn't matter, because the end product is the same. The end product is totalitarianism, is dictatorship. The end product is always an elite ruling as much as they, I say elite, I call them the parasite class, a parasite class ruling as much as they possibly can. So if they can unify the globe and rule over it, they'll sell it differently in China than they will in the US, but it's the same thing. It's the same end product. The end product is behavioral control of humanity. And that is what the Dark Enlightenment ultimately leads to. Although they'll argue that what it's really about is providing a better society and moving humanity through what they've decided human evolution should be. I mean, that's another point as well. So these people like Thiel and Land, they are assuming they are God. I mean, they've killed God completely. They are, we will decide what human evolution will be. It's our role to do that. So the idea of a kind of natural, us having any kind of link to our kind of natural world and our own spirituality, they either can't see it. Perhaps these people are so kind of autistic in a way that they cannot connect with any kind of human spiritual experience or not. I don't know.
You're absolutely right. They are autistic. These people are extremely autistic. They're horrible people. I hate autistics. Like, I've had to deal with them for like 10 years, and they're the worst people ever. They have a thing in their brain. They can't understand anything that isn't, not even, I don't even want to say logical, because they have their own warped logic. But yes, they're completely incapable of even understanding this, the concept of a spiritual experience, which is why these ideas and Platonism resonate so well, because Plato is the first guy who's like super anti-mysticism and metaphysics. And once you get rid of the gods or the divine or the concept of the transcendence, something that's not material, once you destroy that, once you have an atheist revolution, which is what happened in Athens as well, once you have that, all you have is naked will to power. That's the only thing that's left. It's just social engineering, and then it's just about who has enough will or organizational might to put themselves on top and to socially engineer society to their liking. If you have a transcendent, spiritual, sort of metaphysical view of the world and people's place in it, you, instead of just imposing your will blindly on people and declaring yourself God, you try to figure out what is the divine order, and you try to take inspiration from that. So you look up and you say, okay, as above, let's try and make it as below. So yeah, it's once you kill God, like you said, all you have is Nietzsche, will to power, Plato, social engineering, and I don't know, like tech Kabbalah or whatever.
Sorry, you carry on, mate.
Oh, the last thing I wanted to say was, can we talk a little bit more about this weird pivot, like where Nick Land was a cybernetic Marxist, and then all of a sudden he starts sort of being on the right wing, and then Like, how is any of this? Maybe this is redundant because we're just saying that these people are all pushing towards the same totalitarian goal. But maybe you could comment on that.
Well, I think, you know, I mean, you got to think, you know, Warwick University in the 1980s. You know, they were punks. They called themselves cyberpunks. So, you know, they got this kind of smash the state kind of attitude. They were younger. You know, they were younger then. Land was younger then. So at the time, in the UK, which is a period I remember distinctly, Margaret Thatcher was in power. So, you know, everybody was left wing. You know, I mean, she was a nightmare, and most nearly, you know, certainly the intellectuals at university rebelled very, very strongly against her, which ironically, you know, her economic ideas, Thatcherism, which was really a kind of reworked version of, you know, ideas that were coming out of the US, the kind of the start of the kind of neoliberal revolution and sort of deregulation of markets, and it's something very much which is, you know, been adopted now by everybody in terms of, you know, both on the left and the right. So, you know, this is the way forward, apparently. You know, and I mean, I you won't get me arguing for regulation of markets, because I don't think there should be any. But I mean, but the point is, we got to look at Peter Thiel, I would imagine, for Land's transition from the right to the left. But I mean, what I would suggest that is just a relabeling. It's just a relabeling of ideas from one, you know, what's something that was iconoclastic and sort of smashed the state was considered to be left wing in 1980s Britain. And now it's considered to be kind of centrist to right to kind of, and which is crazy when you think about, you know, we've got ruling party in the UK, the Conservative Party. So conservatism means conservation of what is, who are hell bent for leather to smash everything to pieces. So it's, you know, and that's what, that goes back to what I was talking about in terms of what these people say and what they mean and what they actually believe. I mean, I strongly suspect that, you know, talking about this kind of idea that this kind of soulless, no connection to the human experience and no connection to kind of any kind of empathy or anything like that. That is common. That is common across the entire parasite class, and the political class that serves them, I would suggest. And it doesn't really matter whether they're what we call them. We can call them Labour, we can call them left, we can call them right, we can call them communists, we could call them conservatives, we could call them Democrats, Republicans. It doesn't make any difference. It's just a different flavour of the same thing, and the same thing is and always was and always is oligarchical power. That's where the buck stops there. This notion that Land presented in the Dark Enlightenment was really sort of injecting, and this is where the accelerationism idea come, you know, with what we now talk about as accelerationism, or we, you and I are, very few people do, is to inject some urgency into it. Now, I think you can look at kind of, certainly look at the 2008 financial crash, and although this was published, you know, before, you know, the real kind of onset or was it actually? I'm not sure when it was published. When did he publish Dark Enlightenment? It was, I think it was after the financial crash. It was a response to the financial crash.
I think it was 2011, perhaps.
Yeah. No, it was. It was after the financial crash. Yeah, so a big part of it is a response to that, isn't it? But that's where I think, you know, if we look at the kind of global economic situation, that's where that sense of urgency came from for those that profit from that system, from the international monetary and financial system. So they could see it falling apart anyway. So what are your options? Shore it up and try and make it last longer, or surge ahead with its replacement. And I think that for people like Thiel, maybe not so much Land, but people like Thiel and his investors in the Founders Fund, they would be very keen to push ahead with a new system. So, and I don't think that's got much to do with political ideology, if I'm, you know, in my view. I know Thiel has written a lot about political ideology and has written a lot about his ideas about democracy and so on. But I don't think the impetus is not coming from that. The impetus is coming from a need to change the system that exists because it's failing, and we want a new one, but we want a new one that still serves us. That's what's important. It, whatever the new one system's going to be, it's got to serve us. And that's where the drive for all this comes from, in my view.
Right. So you said that they're all for disruption. That's part of acceleration, is to make to undermine the system and to accelerate its collapse, and so that a new order can consolidate itself. What are some of the ways that they promote this disruption? Since it's mostly a Silicon Valley-based thing, are they just trying to develop new technology that will be a disruptor? Like, you know, it's not truly AI, but there are all these AI-ish programs coming out, like ChatGPT and OpenAI and this sort of thing. And it seems to really be causing a lot of panic in several. So liberalism is actually based on liberal institutions. So liberalism is a very fragile thing, which only exists because of several coercive institutions working together, like a leviathan, like the tentacles of an octopus, who are always monitoring and searching out and destroying threats to liberalism that can emerge from within and from without society. So liberalism is in that sense, it's always on high alert. And so one of these institutions that's essential for liberalism is a controlled media, which is run by the reigning class of oligarchs and political operatives who serve the interests of the oligarchs. That's a prerequisite for liberalism. Is ruled by rich businessmen, and that's it's considered a good thing. Lobbying is considered these people sort of paying, or these people voting with their money, right? It's inherent to the system. I'm not talking about corruption. Corruption is only corruption if it's a deviation from the norm. This is the norm. This is how it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be about oligarchs being able to run society as they see fit. This is the whole liberal ideal. So one of the key institutions is the media. And the media seems to be really freaking out because of these developments, these technological developments. They seem to be scared that you know, an unleashed AI, people can have conversations with it, and it can tell them answers to their questions that are unmonitored, that are uncurated. It can also pull up information that isn't being, like, you know, Wikipedia is run by the CIA, which, you know, the Spooks is another institution. Spooks control, work with the media, work with the oligarchy. Anyway, all these are all liberal institutions. So anyway, is that what they're doing? Are they developing new tech that will be disruptive to the current status quo? Or how are they being disruptive? Yeah, I mean,
there's so many different ways that they're being disruptive. So, you know, in a way, this is a continuation of everything that's gone before. As we've just discussed, as you've just highlighted, it's the continuation of oligarch power. So that's the fixed element to it. But what they're doing through, I mean, this is a completely separate issue, but it was certainly brought up in Land's Dark Enlightenment, when he was talking about, you know, breaking the cathedral apart, or doing an inventory of the cathedral. So if you're breaking that into shares and inviting people in to be shareholders in that system, that is stakeholder capitalism. That's what Schwab called stakeholder capitalism. So the idea that you have stakeholders who make decisions rather than a democratic electorate. You know, you would have, which is an anathema. I mean, it's ridiculous to think that electorates make decisions. Of course they don't. You know, they never have. I mean, but you know, this is stakeholder capitalism. So that's one aspect of how that system will work. But looking at things like the financial sector, fintech, so breaking apart the existing monetary system, for example. So, you know, the monetary system that we have hitherto been used to for the last, you know, well, certainly since, the coming off the gold standard and going to the petrodollar and things like that, you know, the fiat money currency system, that is set to continue in terms of its, you know, status as a system of usury and creating money out of nothing, creating money out of thin air. But the way that we will use money and what money actually is, that is being destroyed, pulled apart by fintech. You know, the basis of, you know, the global financial markets that are being tokenized assets. So tokenization means breaking things apart into its constituent, you know, shares. So like at the moment, you might buy an ounce of gold. In the future, you might buy a tokenized fund in a gold bar, and you so many tokens. And this enables economy to go virtual. So if you think of a forest, for example, you know, we see a forest as a beautiful thing, and something that we might like to take the dog for a walk in. They see it as a carbon sequestration service. So a carbon sequestration service, right, has monetary value because it absorbs, you know, a measurable amount of carbon. And if you put a price on carbon, then I say carbon, that it's very easy to fall into using their language. Everything's made out of carbon. So when they say carbon, they don't mean carbon. What they mean is carbon dioxide, which is not carbon. But you know, we end up using this language, don't we? You know, I slip into it. But it sequesters a measurable amount of carbon dioxide per hour or whatever. So you can put a monetary value on that as a service. And that's what they're intending to do. They're intending to tokenize everything. So, you know, your life, for example, you know, what is the productive, and this goes back to technocracy, which there's a massive overlap with technocracy and what Land was talking about. But your life has a productive value. You know, 40 years of work in a factory produces X amount of goods worth this amount of money. So therefore, you can be tokenized. Your working life can be tokenized. I mean, a lot of people talk about what they call the Sescovay Trust, which is your parallel legal identity, which is afforded to you when you are registered with a birth certificate. So that is a separate trust that stands alone and represents you in the kind of legal system, which we might call maritime law, and the legal system of contract law. Now, that can be tokenized. So everything can be tokenized and converted into an equivalent monetary value that can form the basis of a new global economy. And that's what they're trying to do. They're shifting away from real world kind of value and moving towards an assessment of value. And then when we think about this, right, so tokenized stuff can all be put together into tradable things like exchange tradable funds or exchange traded funds. So these can all be put together into securities that can then be traded on the derivatives market. So they're creating wealth for themselves at our ultimately completely at our expense. Now that is very much what Land and Thiel and Yavin are advocating in the Dark Enlightenment. So, you know, this is appealing to those people who wish for there to be a more efficient management of society by a technocratic kind of empowered class, which is very similar to technocracy, which is what
tech priests, that's what they want to be. They want tech to be priest.
yeah
and they want to like serve the machine spirit. I'm not even kidding, like that's, I've seen some of the language that they use. A lot of it's sourced from, you said cyberpunk is like a sci-fi genre, which I've read quite a bit of. Have you ever read any cyberpunk yourself?
I'm not aware of reading any cyberpunk. Who's a cyberpunk writer?
The big one everyone knows is Gibson, and he wrote this book called Neuromancer. And Neuromancer is about this sort of cyberpunk dystopia of the future. Everybody who's into this tech stuff, Silicon Valley stuff, they know about this. This is like their Bible.
Right. I'll have to check it out.
It's actually a good read. But, you know, the guy who writes it reveals a lot about his view of the world. And you've actually, even though you haven't read it, or you don't even know about the genre, you've sort of touched on some of the themes that are found in the book. Like, for example, God is conceptualized as basically like, consciousness is conceptualized basically as software. And God is conceptualized as a programmer. And it's basically the demiurge. It's Platonic deism, again. And it's this idea of becoming gods yourself by basically learning how to code reality. But in that, there's the people who run the show are powerful tech companies. And the governments barely even exist. There's only economic zones and powerful. And then this has spawned a lot of similar work. So, for example, there's Ghost in the Shell, which is also a staple of the genre. Everybody knows it. And it's about cyborgs. It's about uploading consciousness to the internet, about how it's about how an AI is born. It says that basically like DNA is basically information. It's code. You know, there's, instead of zeros and ones, there's four. I don't know what they are. C, B, T, G, A. There's four. I forget. You know what I'm talking about, right? And so basically binary is code as well. And so out of the information of the net, out of the information of just computer information, a consciousness could emerge, because it's like that's the DNA. So, and then it's about how a human can upload their consciousness to the internet. And then so there's all these different themes that are very similar. So they're talking about, again, tech companies, tech barons running things. There's Altered Carbon is a show based on, I think, books as well. And I mean, there's that carbon that, again.
I mean, that's a good example, isn't it? I mean, I've only seen a couple of those Altered Carbon things. I've been, you know, around someone's house and they were watching it. And what struck me about it was it made me feel, watching it, there was something I couldn't quite put my finger on, but it made me feel uncomfortable. It made me feel like my flesh was crawling a bit. And I think the thing was that struck me about it. I mean, I wasn't able to kind of rationalize this at the time, but in retrospect, it was soulless. It's soulless. It's got no, it didn't have any kind of element of kind of human. There was something.
The premise is that you can take consciousness, soul stuff, and you can shove it into binary, that you can upload people's souls into different bodies, that you can be a white kung fu master one day, you can be a Asian lady masseuse the next day. Yeah, it's a destruction of identity. It's technology approaching the levels of black magic, and all of it is very, very materialistic, fundamentally.
Yeah, I mean, if you think, I mean, you can listen to, you know, a sort of a piece of music from the 18th century or something like that that was, you know, written. I mean, there's a piece of music, Concerto de Ramway. I'm not sure when that was written, but I mean, it's a beautiful bit of music that I really like. And it's very emotive, and it's very, you know, it's emotionally stirring. Now, the composer wrote that to elicit that emotion in the 18th century. 250 odd years later, I can listen to the same piece of music and understand every aspect of what that composer was trying to convey, and feel it just as he felt it when he wrote it over time, throughout time. AI is never going to be able to do that. It will never be able to do it. The idea, and that is, and what's that part of our consciousness? I mean, then we get into talking about what is consciousness, how much of it is internal and how much of it is external. But AI just, it can't do that. I mean, recently someone asked a question of an AI. I mean, what we've got, obviously, what we are shown, and like things like ChatGPT and stuff like that, is pretty basic stuff. But someone asked a question to AI, and this is quite funny. Would it be okay to misgender Caitlyn Jenner if it stopped a nuclear holocaust? Right. So this is a basic question. Now, for any rational being, right, the answer is yeah, of course it's okay to misgender someone if it stops a nuclear holocaust, because the two things are not comparable. Right. AI couldn't figure that out. It could not figure that out. AI came back and said no, because it's been programmed. It's just a mindless, soulless, idiotic program. It couldn't figure that out. It came back and said, no, it's not okay to misgender Caitlyn Jenner to prevent a nuclear holocaust. Under no circumstances must you, because it's been told, and that's all it knows. It can't think. That's the point. It can't think. It just knows what it is told. I mean, unfortunately, one of the arguments that, you know, people like us perhaps make a few times is that we are running the risk of being a nation or a society of people that can't think. But if all you've got is what you were told, and you can't extrapolate from that in a based upon not just logic, but your experience of the world and what it is to be a living being, and make judgments based on that, which means being, you know, aware of emotional truth as well, and spiritual truth as well as logic. If you can't do that, which AI can't, you end up just spewing it. It just spews out abject nonsense. So, you know, I think, you know, I mean, as I said, I mean, I don't think things like ChatGPT are the forefront of AI for one moment, and I'm not suggesting that they are. But nonetheless, it seems to be a very, very, very long way from being any kind of sort of meaningful conscious thing. So the idea of the singularity, I think it's a mythos at the moment.
Yeah, but, you know, I think AI will replace a lot of people's jobs. And
oh, definitely.
I think it will like raise these questions of what it means to be a human, because well, I have a view that a lot of people are kind of like automatons. They do seem like NPCs. And yeah. AI, for example, this is pretty funny. Like men, you know, most men would be interested in getting like a robot wife. There's a movie, Blade Runner. There's several movies actually now, but Blade Runner 2, 2049, there's the main character. He has a holographic wife or girlfriend. I don't know their marital status, but then, and he's very much in love with this holographic programmed wife. And There's another movie with Joaquin Phoenix. It's called Her, I think, and it's about.
Oh yeah. I think
so. But it's not just a thought experiment, because there are men right now who are tinkering with these chat systems and getting them to approximate the behavior of like a loving wife or something like that. And it's good enough. It's already in Japan, they have these holographic, they're like 2D plus, sort of, what do you call them? Like cartoon, like avatar type, like a virtual girlfriend. Anyway, my point is that a lot of men seem to prefer this sort of thing, and frankly, I don't blame them. But that's another thing that's gonna. So people are gonna be asking themselves a lot of questions about what it means to be human if you move away, if you do away with like many things that were used to be the province of humans. My answer to that question is that it has to be the spiritual component. Like that's the only thing that's really left to humans, is to take spirituality a little bit more seriously and to make it a more important part of their lives, especially when all these other avenues are kind of closed to them, you know? But I don't know. What are your thoughts? Is there any room for that in Dark Enlightenment, Accelerationism, or are they just like, no, like this? What is their position on it?
In terms of what? In terms of us having relationships with machines?
sure, on that. But in general, like, what is their, you know, if they're pushing for all this tech stuff, are they cognizant of the fact that it's going to lead to an existential crisis for like millions and billions of people? Do they? Is that what they want?
No, they want to just wipe. Yeah. No, I don't think that. No, I don't think that occurs to them. Because as we were going back to what we were saying earlier, they're disconnected from, you know, the human experience. I mean, that shines through in the Dark Enlightenment. It is. I mean, is it evil? Could you say it was evil? It is not consciously morally. There's no moral judgment in it. It's empty of any kind of empathy about anything. You know, it's almost as if AI had written it, but this it wasn't written by AI. It was written by human beings, but human beings that are disassociated from the condition of humanity, I would suggest, because they talk about basically changing us. So when we talk about transhumanism, It's got a very strong element of transhumanism in it, because they see transhumanism as the future of evolution. And we keep hearing that from people like Harari and people like that, that are always banging on about how our futures must be melded to technology. Whereas, you know, this is just it's the same idea as saying, you know, we must have sustainable development, we must have this, we must have that. Who's making these decisions? Why must we? There are plenty of people that would say, no, we don't need any of that. In fact, there are plenty
of philosopher kings.
The philosopher kings, yeah. Which, you know, that's what they're dabbling in, you know, and that's exactly where people like Land and Thiel are heading. Towards that kind of position as being the kind of, well, you know, openly stating the leaders of the new enlightenment, but calling it a dark enlightenment. But I mean,
dark enlightenment, am I right?
the dark enlightenment. Yeah, I mean, it is. These people are nerds. I mean, they're out and out nerds. I mean, if they even acknowledge that. In you know, as part of it, these they calling themselves neo-reactionaries, right? But I think at one point, even if memory serves, somewhere just openly stated, yeah, that means we're nerds. But nerds that are assuming, the power to rule humanity, that they should be. I mean, that in itself, think about that. Think about being a human being who assumes they know what is best for 8 billion other human beings. I mean, that in itself is insane. It's insane. There's no kind of the belief system that you need to construct in your life, however that's happened, whether it's from your nurturing or otherwise, the belief system that you need to construct in your life to bring you to a point where you think you have the right to tell 7.8 billion other people what to do is the product of delusion.
Have you ever interacted with these? I've interacted with probably close to like 50 of them at this point. I think they should be hunted. They should be identified at a young age and hunted down and like put on the ice floes of like Antarctica and then just cast out to sea. I can't deal with these. I mean, I've had to deal with these people for like 10 years. They're the worst dregs of humanity. They all think that they're amazing because they're fundamentally broken like that. They think they teach themselves that autism is their superpower, right? Like some say it ironically, but most of them don't understand what irony even is. But so they basically say, well, I'm like hyper logical. And it's like, listen, these people, if the peas touch the mashed potatoes, they'll have a mental breakdown. They have tiny little comfort zones, you know. They can barely even like swing a baseball bat. Like they can't appreciate nature. All they can do is just sit like in a hunchback position, like a folded over shrimp, staring into the screen and like, you know, obsessively. And they're all like, and the thing is that they're not actually smart because, you know, they lack any wisdom. So they become ideologists, almost all of them. They get really into this, like seeking out the perfect political system, and they'll get into these really obscure things. Like they'll say, I'm a neo Juche, like whatever the North Korean thing is. It's like I'm into neo Juche, and they'll like tell you about the tenets of that, and they'll say I'm into, and then they'll splice together all these words. I'm a Leninist, reactionaryist, vanguardist, like environmentalist. Yeah. Cabalist, you know, it's an ism or an ist. Yeah, and they're basically like trying to code everything. Their whole approach to life is that of a coder. They're trying to reduce everything to simple, you know. They can't even eat complex foods, for Christ's sakes. I mean, have you seen these people try to eat? I'm sorry, like, I mean, yeah, I understand that. No, but they can't. They can only eat like ketchup and chicken nuggets, like baby food. They can't understand like a wide variety of palate.
The elite or people with autism or both?
People with autism. Well, but yeah, I mean, look, autism is one of the many mental illnesses that I think the elite has. I think the number one thing that they have is psychopathy, the elite. Yeah. But, you know, narcissism, bipolar disorder, you know, there's like five big traits that like five big bad personality or psychological traits, and a lot of autistics exhibit at least like three of them. They just lack the sort of the competency or the ruthlessness to sort of get them into the ranks of the elite is what I would say. So if they were a little bit more competent.
Yeah. Right, so I've worked with a lot of autistic people. I you know, in my previous working life as social worker, I worked with a lot of people with autism. So autism is a spectrum, right? It's a neurological disorder. There's a spectrum of autism, and there are it can be characterized at one end of the autistic spectrum. You get people who really can't function at all because you know they don't perceive reality. And it would be fascinating to know how autistic people perceive reality that are what you might call the extreme end of the autistic spectrum.
Well, that's the extreme end of NPCs. I'm telling you, that's like what the elite want us to be. They want us to be like these robots. I mean, I'm sorry, like I feel bad for them, but it's like whatever, man. Like we got to quarantine.
No. One end you've got people that are non-verbal, So they can't feed themselves. They can't look after themselves at all. So they're severely disabled by autism. But at the other end of the spectrum, you've got high functioning people that are autistic, which I suggest we might find, you know, people like, I'm not saying that he is autistic, but I mean, he shows some of the traits of autism, people like Land. You know,
Zuckerberg.
Zuckerberg, yeah. So that end, and people saying, you know, autism is a superpower. Autism is not in any way, shape, or form a superpower, because autism it disinhibits your ability to be able to understand human relationships. So one of the things that high functioning autistic people struggle with is that they don't understand visual cues, and they don't understand an environment. So that one of the things they tend to do, high functioning people, is that they'll go into a room and start talking about subject that nobody else is interested in, but they, yeah. they can't see that nobody else is interested. They don't pick up on that cue, right? So they don't know that nobody else is interested. All that matters to them is that they are interested, right? So this is what they want to talk about. If someone talks to a high-functioning autistic, and this is quite common, and I'm not, you know, you can't generalize here, because, you know, people with autism are all completely different, just like the rest of us. But one thing that is difficult for people with autism to do is engage in anything that isn't interesting to them. Now, that is the same to a certain extent for the rest of us. We don't want to do stuff that's not interesting for us, but we will do it, you know, for example, to earn money. So we'll do a job that we find, you know, incredibly dull and we're not interested in, just to earn money. People
will be polite. We'll be polite. These people can't be polite. I had this guy. The thing is, I don't think it's fully genetic. I think it's like a thing that you can get. I think it's related to gut. I've read a lot about it. It's also related to it's like a legit, like, what you think about can make your autism worse. Like, if you indulge in your autism, like, you will make it worse if you don't try to, you know, work on it. I'm sitting there, and this guy also takes like meth, right? So I mean, it's just micro doses of meth. He's sitting there for 4 hours, not blinking, not once blinking, just talking about some garbage, and I'm trying to do my work, and it's just hell with these people, honestly.
it can be definitely.
And that's what they are in Silicon Valley. That's the whole thing. And those are the high functioning ones. They're just sort of sitting there like robots. Like, I don't want to be a coder. I don't want to do, like, these are the only jobs that make any money. I don't want to do any of them because I'm not like that. You know, I got a good score on my math. Like, I was very top tier math, whatever. I think I could handle it. I can't handle this sort of lifestyle or this worldview that these people have, or just being around them. I can't. And that's what they want to make a significant portion of humanity. They want to spread their disease. Trust me, these are horrible people. Anyway, that's just how I conceptualize the mentality of the elite, just with a little bit more proactive ruthlessness added to the mix. So that's why I'm
definitely they value that. I mean, certainly that's present in Land's work, you know, the total lack of any kind of appreciation of the human condition, really. I mean, that's very clear in what he's written about. If we want to talk about accelerationism, this notion of acceleration, do you want to move on and talk about that?
I thought we already did. Add something to it. Go ahead.
But being kind of like specifically about accelerationism, that does come from what the people that are identified as being on the left. So there was a guy called Nick Cernicek. I'm going to murder this name. Nick Cernicek, I think. Would you pronounce it? And he wrote something called the Accelerationist Manifesto. Well, so his idea about accelerationism, and I'll do a quote here. So I'm talking about breaking things apart. So here we go. Quote, today's politics is beset by an inability to generate the new ideas and modes of organization necessary to transform our societies, to confront the resolve the coming annihilations. So a big part of the Dark Enlightenment and this accelerationist manifesto, which is very much a similar thing, is this notion of crisis. Giorgio Agamben spoke about, you know, a permanent state of crisis politically. So everything's a crisis. So if you want to, and talking about, you know, when we were talking earlier about how are they breaking things apart? Well, because everything is a crisis. So you can't just, you know, have a kind of sort of a kind of rational sit back and think about things and approach things in some sort of kind of moderate fashion. Everything has to be approached as if it's an annihilation. So, you know, the climate's changing. It's not that the planet's warming up a bit and wouldn't that be nice because we'll have more trees. No, it's because it's an annihilation. You know, it's not that some of the global kind of supply chains are breaking down and therefore we might have to rethink about how we kind of manage the transport of goods and services. No. It's a total catastrophe. It's a crisis of capitalism or a crisis of, you know, of our modern way of life. People, I mean, we just had the incredible scenes in the UK where the unelected Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, wanders out onto a podium, which outside Number 10, which is normally reserved for making serious announcements about, you know, going to war and things like that. Because a few people protested outside of a constituency, a member of Parliament's house. This has created a snowball effect in the Houses of Parliament. And he's now talking about how they need to battle extremism. Right. So from that, they've extrapolated another crisis. So we are constantly in this perpetual cycle of reaction to crisis. Now, Land called his process of moving forward through the Dark Enlightenment neo-reactionism. And that's that. And this is when we were talking earlier about how this has pervaded everything. That's what we're seeing. Constant knee-jerk reactionism to everything. Everything has got to be perceived as a crisis. And the left, when they were talking about this Cernicek, when he was talking about this accelerationist manifesto, you know, he went on to say that, quote, "We believe the important divisions in today's left is between those that hold folk politics of localism," so as in, you know, the politics of your community and representing your community or choosing someone to represent your community. "And those that outline what must become called an accelerationist politics at ease with modernity and abstraction, complexity, globality and technology." So forget about the things that are important to you in your local community. None of that matters. Forget about it. Forget about fixing the potholes. Forget about, you know, having a decent health service that you can actually access. Forget about all of that. That doesn't matter. What matters are the global issues like climate change. That's all that matters. And everything must be geared around that. So how are
sorry, go ahead.
So what they want to do is take these global crises, which we are seeing all the time, and this is why I was going back earlier saying that we are seeing accelerationism everywhere. Take these global crises, package them as an underlying reason to panic, and convince everyone in every local community around the world that they should panic, because this is everything's an existential threat. And in doing that, if you can convince everyone to do that, which is what the Accelerationist Manifesto is all about, which is the left labeled side of Land's kind of dark enlightenment, if you can convince everyone to do that, they will accept doing what they are told in order to save themselves from this dire global emergency, even though they might be sitting where, you know, I'm sitting at the moment overlooking the city of Portsmouth. It's a beautiful day. The birds are singing. The grass is growing. People are going about their daily business. And there is absolutely no reason why I should be worried about climate change. But if they can convince everybody to internalize that fear, then it can be used to control people's behavior. And that's the same on the left side, the Accelerationist Manifesto, as it is on the so-called right side, the Dark Enlightenment.
Well, sad thing is that the left is controlled and the right is controlled, and that, you know, it doesn't seem like that's gonna ever change. So, you know, people that can sort of avoid falling for this are few and far between. But we're doing our part, I guess. It's up to people to sort of extract themselves from these false dichotomies and from these controlled, what do you call them, like political projects. At the end of the day, I don't think most of us are slated to be the philosopher kings of the utopia to come. And we should probably show a little bit more peasant solidarity and a little bit more skepticism about these strange people with strange cognitive disorders, neurological disorders, who write in strange ways, who get strange sources of cash inflow sent to them by equally strange people in positions of power. You know, we should probably be a little bit more skeptical about these people. But what do I know? Anyway, do you have any final thoughts?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And one of our problems that we have, I mean, I think the key problem, and you hit the nail right on the head there, is that the people that are kind of, you know, like our political class, for example, the people that are doing the ordering us about are following the directives and the orders of these nutters. They're following their directives and they're serving them. And our problem is, And I suspect that's because they believe that when the chips finally fall, they will get a seat at the table, and they're not gonna. They're just as disposable as the rest of us. So it would be great. It would be great if they come to realize, you know, I'm talking about, you know, what we might call at a global level, the middle management. If they can wrap their heads around the fact that they're just as expendable as the rest of us, then that's, you know, that would be a good day. Because once that happens, I think that, you know, we stand a better chance of, as you put it, some peasant solidarity. Because all these things like left and right and black and white and gay and straight and male and female, all these divisions are created to keep us at each other's throats. And while we do that, we're not focusing on who the real threat is. And the real threat is the parasite class and the globalist order that is trying to control all of us.
Yeah, I think people need to reacquaint themselves with their own identity. And a lot of the people who talk about utopian projects and transhumanism are not at ease with their own identity for whatever reason, either because they're deficient in some way, or they don't feel at ease in one culture, they're a product of two cultures or more, they feel like they are an interloper, they feel like they're antagonistic to the culture, whatever. Like you said, they think that they're going to get a slice of the pie at the end of the day, which they won't. So yeah, we need to have a reaffirmation of identity, I would say. Like just being acknowledging, hey, we're kind of, I'm not that special. I think I'm great. I'm sure everybody would agree. But, you know, I'm not getting any slice of the pie. I should probably, you know, I should probably like try and find a common language with the other people who are not going to get a slice of the pie and be like, okay, look, I don't agree with you on everything. I'm much taller and much more handsome and much more smarter than you. And you should accept that. But, you know, we should
almost at least... certainly, we've never seen each other, but you almost certainly are.
Well, thank you. Finally, someone acknowledges it, takes it on faith. That's all it requires. Take it on faith. No, anyway, but yeah, I agree. Thank you so much for the talk. Thanks for explaining this. A fresh new horror is added to the list that we should be on the lookout for. And my message, yeah, it's the same. We should just try and have a little bit more solidarity instead of being at each other's throats. So on that note, thank you again, Mr. Ian Davis. I'd like to talk to you again in the near future. I hope you had as good of a time as I did.
No, yeah, it was brilliant, mate. Always enjoyed talking to you. It was really good. All the best.
All right, till next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.